Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can find and explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of multidimensional writer Shirley Jackson, perhaps best known for her horror novels and short stories. We're joined by three guests whose lives and careers have been influenced greatly by Jackson in different ways. Lawrence Jackson Hyman is the eldest child of Shirley Jackson and Stanley Edgar Hyman. He spent most of his professional life in publishing as a writer, photographer, editor, art director, and publisher. He is the author, editor, and co-editor of dozens of books and monographs, including two posthumous collections of his mother's stories, Just an Ordinary Day and Let Me Tell You. He was an executive producer for the 2018 film adaptation We Have Always Lived in the Castle. Bernice M. Murphy is an associate professor and lecturer in popular literature at the School of English, Trinity College, Dublin. She has published extensively on topics related to American horror fiction and film and edited the 2005 collection Shirley Jackson, Essays on the Literary Legacy. Her latest monograph, The California Gothic in Fiction and Film, has just been completed and will be published by Edinburgh University Press in summer 2022. Ellen Datlow has been editing science fiction, fantasy, and horror short fiction for four decades. She was the fiction editor of Omni Magazine and Science Fiction, and currently acquires short stories and novellas for Tor.com and Nightfire. She's won multiple awards for her editing, including the 2007 Carl Edward Wagner Award, given at the British Fantasy Convention for outstanding contribution to the genre, and the Life Achievement Award given by the Horror Writers Association, among others. She has edited numerous anthologies for adults, young adults, and children, including the Best Horror of the Year annual series, Echoes, the Saga Anthology of Ghost Stories, and most recently, When Things Get Dark, stories inspired by Shirley Jackson. They are interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
Well, Lawrence, Bernice, Ellen, thank you all for being here with me today. I want to get started with a little bit about, tell me about yourselves and how you first encountered Jackson's work or what her work means to you. Lawrence, I think maybe starting with you is a good spot to start.
All right. I'm Lawrence Jackson Hyman. I'm the oldest child of Shirley Jackson and Stanley Edgar Hyman. So I met them both long ago. For about the past 20 years, I've managed my mother's literary estate, and I've done three books of her work. One, Just an Ordinary Day in 1996, a collection of previously unpublished and uncollected work, which my sister and I uncovered in various places, but many of the stories came from the Library of Congress, where my parents' papers are held. The second book I did was Let Me Tell You. I think that was 6 years ago. And that was a second collection of previously unpublished work, together with some essays and other writings. And then recently, the last 4 years, I've spent working with Bernice on The Letters of Shirley Jackson, which came out in July and has been reviewed very favorably. People seem to get it, that this is really my mother's voice and her own speaking pattern, her own phrasing, her own way of using language. So the letters, I think, are particularly revealing in that way. I hope other people continue to agree.
I just started that, and I'm looking forward to reading more.
Yeah, it's great. Bernice, maybe you could tell me, since you helped on the letters as well, a little bit about yourself and your relationship to Jackson and her work.
Yeah, so I was the academic sort of scholarly consultant to Lawrence as he edited the collection. It's a great honor and a pleasure to do so. I'm an associate professor of popular literature at the School of English, Trinity College, Dublin. And I did my PhD thesis on Shirley Jackson, and I did it at a time where there'd been a little bit of academic interest in her, some excellent work done in the 80s and 90s, but she was really quite neglected at that stage, which is certainly no longer the case, I'm happy to say. A lot of great work out there by great academics. I edited the first ever essay collection on Jackson back in 2005, which was Shirley Jackson Essays on the Literary Legacy. And I've also written various book chapters and articles about Jackson. So she's someone who's kind of been one of my major research interests. And I'm also just a massive fan of Shirley Jackson. I genuinely think she's one of the most significant American writers of the 20th century. And it's wonderful to see her get the attention that she so richly deserves.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. And Ellen, how about a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a science fiction, fantasy, and horror short story editor, and I've been editing since short fiction since around 1980 or so. I became aware of Shirley Jackson's work at 12. I remember around 12 years old, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and I adored it. And I read some of her short stories. Of course, The Lottery, everyone used to have to read it in junior high or wherever, or maybe even earlier, I don't remember. But I've always enjoyed short stories. But also I remember reading Life Among the Savages, some of her nonfiction books, and enjoying those. I mean, they were really charming and weird. So I've been an ongoing reader of her work and appreciate her work. And the last few years I've read, I think the Ruth Franklin biography. And I've been involved with the Shirley Jackson Awards at ReaderCon. So that's kind of how, in a way, I got into the idea of doing an anthology of writers inspired by her work, because that award is intended to honor writers who write weird fiction, dark fiction. So that's kind of how I got into doing the anthology. But I've always been a fan of Jackson's work.
That seems to be a running thread. She has so many fans. And especially now, I was just reading before this in the introduction to the letters. I was surprised to learn that when she was actively writing, she didn't get as much scholarly or critical attention as her peers who were writing in the same fields and the same genres, I should say. And Bernice, you wrote, in summary, her gender, versatility, professionalism, and commercial popularity meant that Jackson was frequently deemed less worthy of serious scholarly and critical inquiry than many of her contemporaries. I'm wondering if you could expand on that and why you think that was at that time. And then also why now is there sort of a resurgence in attention given, due attention given to her?
Yeah, I think, and I probably should have put in at the end of that sentence her male contemporaries. Come to think about, because let's face it, there are a lot of men writing in a vaguely similar register in terms of literary fiction, who perhaps didn't get quite. I mean, it wouldn't be accurate to say that Jackson was ever forgotten. There were always people, you know, she wasn't a writer who necessarily had to be rediscovered, but she never quite, particularly after her death, she didn't quite get the critical due. I mean, I think people sometimes overlook as well that she was a big deal in the 50s and the early 60s. She was a high profile writer. She was very much in the media. She was giving lots of interviews. She was in, you know, her later books appeared in bestseller lists. She was doing really well and she was high profile, but a lot of that did die off after her early death. And absolutely, I think partially it's because critics, academics in particular, weren't quite sure where to place her. She kind of confused them. She wrote for women's magazines, but she also published in the likes of the New Yorker or you know, the Saturday Evening Post. She was someone who wrote literary fiction, but also it was literary fiction with a decidedly gothic kind of sensibility. And then there were the volumes of family stories, which did very well at the time and were in fact for a long time maybe some of her most high profile works. And I think she caused confusion. She couldn't be easily categorized. She was incredibly versatile, and I think in a strange way that can sometimes work against a writer, particularly one who sort of straddles what you might call, you know, I'm putting this in quotation marks, highbrow and lowbrow sort of publication and she wrote, she used genre, you know, she wrote science fiction stories, she wrote horror, she wrote gothic, as well as all of that. So all of that, and I think in a weird way, a lot of the things that worked against her for, you know, maybe a generation critically are precisely the kinds of things that mean that she's been so readily re-embraced now. I think her versatility is something that people are more aware of really than they have been since, you know, before her death. And that's part of the reason why You know, she's gone from being what you might say kind of a writer's writer. Like she was always, I'm sure Ellen would be very well aware of, she's always highly considered within the horror community. She was always one of the huge names, but she's now become mainstream again in a way that I think is absolutely fascinating, which I think also has a lot to do with, I won't go on at greater length, I think it's a lot to do with her depiction of women and her of the female experience. And I think, frankly, there's a lot more respect given for that now these days than perhaps was the case in the 70s, the 80s, and even the 90s.
I like what you say, Bernice, about the straddling of the genres and that being an issue, because today, many of the writers, some of the writers in my anthology, but many writers are straddling genres, mainstream and literary and gothic and horror. And the push that they've made. I mean, Joyce Carol Oates cannot be ignored anymore. Mm. You know, she's writes everything. And other writers, Brian Evanson, Elizabeth Hand, Kelly Link, many writers now who are very popular do write different genre work. And yes, it's still hard to sell them. Their publishers probably hate what they're doing, but they've gotten more respect from readers and the media, I think. And I think that is why, you know, that was partly why Jackson did not have the recognition in the last, you know, until more recently that she's come back into the public eye. And also the movies, of course, when people make movies, that brings, whether they're good or bad, they bring the writer back into the public eye, for better or worse.
Well, that's true. And in fact, talking about bad movies, the DreamWorks remake of Haunting of Hill House was dreadful, but it got my mother's name back in the news and people remembered, oh yeah, she also wrote some other books. And, and at that point, Penguin started to reissue her work. And I think that contributed largely to her resurgence now, that they've worked very hard. I've worked pretty hard with them. And they've done a great job. Shirley's books are readily available most anywhere now.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence, I have a question for you that you might not want to answer and you might want to blank this whole thing out. I wonder how you feel about that movie, Shirley.
Yeah, I don't mind talking about it. You know, it's a work of fiction. Doesn't have much to do with my mother. Doesn't have much to do with Susan Merrill's book either. Frankly, I I've talked to Elizabeth Moss about this at some length, and she and I have become friends. She asked me if she had portrayed Shirley in a realistic way. And I said, frankly, no. It's clearly fiction. Too many liberties were taken. I mean, the most obvious one that everyone comments on is the fact that there are no children. And she's just lounging around the house all day, smoking cigarettes, you know, and maybe writing a little bit if she feels like it. That's not the way it was. You know, and it portrays our house in a very unrealistic way. That first scene is great, the party. You can kind of see Ralph Ellison, but it just kind of goes south from there. And I think it unfairly portrays Shirley as something she wasn't. On the other hand, I think Michael Stuhlbarg did a great job with Stanley. And I told him so. I thought he had really grasp Stanley's personality and portrayed it in a fairly realistic way. Mm-hmm. And I thought the use of the blues records was pretty good, very appropriate. Yeah. So, you know, it didn't hurt. We didn't like the novel at all when it came out, and we were very vocal about that. We called it a home invasion novel, which it really kind of was.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was based on a novel.
Yeah, yeah, which itself was a work of fiction. Anyway, the movie got Shirley's name out more. It may have introduced her to people who may not have known her, may not have read her. And hopefully they did then go on and read one or two of her books or stories and attempt to find out what the real Shirley is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good segue actually for me, because one thing I'm curious about, Lawrence, is what the actual home life was, you know, and the balance between writing and caring for a family, and also being the main provider for the family. From what I understand, So could you tell us a little bit about what her process was like in those terms?
Yeah, well, sure. I had a very happy childhood. I grew up in a very intellectually stimulating house. There were also always people visiting. There was always a high level of conversation. And the children were usually expected to be part of it. So Shirley and Stanley led a very scholarly life, really, Stanley especially. Shirley did, as you pointed out, did most of the work. She drove us to doctors and dentists and dance class and Cub Scouts meetings and school when we lived not near school, which was a couple of years. So she was the family chauffeur. Stanley didn't even drive. She cooked, she cleaned the house, she shopped, she did the laundry, she took care of the animals, she took them to the vet when necessary. She really ran the entire household, and when she could, she would repair to her upstairs study and work. And she usually managed to work for at least 4 or 5 hours a day if she could. She would typically send the kids off in the morning and then go to work. And she'd work from, say, 9 to 12. She'd stop, make lunch for everybody, and then she would nap in the afternoon. She would then usually work again in the evenings after dinner. She would make dinner. My sisters would usually take care of the cleanup. Shirley would go upstairs, and we could hear her typing away up there. And that was usually a good thing.
It's a lot of discipline.
Well, yeah, and she must have been tired by 8:30 at night when she'd done all that. And then she goes up and works for two or 3 hours and does beautiful work.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of a day would be a very productive day for her.
Yeah, it's impressive too to me. Yeah, the commitment and dedication to that. Did she write every day or try to at least?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. There were some days she couldn't. And you know, one other thing, I don't remember ever hearing her complain. I mean, really. And I think that's quite important. She, it was her life. She lived it. She did the best she could and she enjoyed it. There was a great deal of laughter and fun and music. My parents loved parties, but those parties would be as intellectually stimulating as anything else. I mean, there'd be writers and sculptors and composers. It would be just great.
Sounds like fun.
It was fun.
We've talked a little bit about current contemporary writers who have been influenced by Shirley Jackson. I wonder if any of you are familiar with any sort of writers before Shirley Jackson that influenced her. And if so, do you see that show up in her writing anywhere?
Shirley read voraciously everything, but mainly Victorian novels. She loved those. Rather obscure novels. She writes about it even, saying, you know, that anyone even thinking of reading this should have lots of spare time on their hands. I don't think, I mean, writers are influenced by lots of things, and Shirley wrote extensively about that, experience and fiction. But I don't know that she was really directly influenced by other writers. I think she worked very hard to develop her own style, which certainly is different from anyone else's writing, and distinctly so, both the comedic work and the serious work.
Yeah, and I'm just going to say that, I mean, in the letters, just to plug the book further, she does talk a bit about what she's reading at a particular time. And one of the interesting things is, I mean, this is something that if anyone's a fan of Jackson's house novels, they might have picked up on. You know, she was a fan of 18th century literature, and she talks about Samuel Richardson being a particular favorite. I think it's Clarissa she mentions at one point as being an ideal. It's got a little reference in Hill House as being like an ideal sort of sleeping pill. You just take it to bed and read two chapters and you'll be off to Never Neverland. She also, I mean, she was a huge fan, like she mentions being a fan of fantasy, which I thought was really interesting. And in a lot of her later letters to a fan called Jean Beattie, she talks about the Oz books, being a huge fan of that. And she talks talks about Tolkien in a really interesting way. So, and you know, as she was also a huge fan of mystery novels as well. So I think, as Lauren said, you can't necessarily pinpoint this is where Jackson got A, B, or C, but she was obviously a voracious reader, and reading other people's work was, I mean, one of the things I find interesting was that when she was working on The Sundial, which is set in, you know, a very mannered kind of country house apocalypse scenario. She was reading a lot of an English novelist called Ivy Compton Burnett, and she talks about, so there is a sense that she was sort of looking at particular authors to almost prep herself as researcher reading particular books. I just mentioned very quickly as well that I think it's sometimes overlooked too that, I mean, she lived with another author as well. She lived with Stanley, and Stanley's work influenced her work in some really interesting ways, and critics such as Shelley Ingram have pointed this out, the extent to which stories like The Lottery or the likes of Handsome Man are influenced really substantially by some of the research that Stanley was doing into myth and ritual and folklore. So you get that sense of an intellectual kind of partnership in a way, where clearly Shirley was talking about these things with Stanley and presumably reading, I mean, sure Lawrence can chip in, but presumably reading many of the same books as Stanley, and that working its way into her novels in a way that is I think starting to be looked at in a wee bit more detail.
That's a good point. And that makes me think of those, like you mentioned, Lawrence, those parties and gatherings with a lot of intellectuals as well. I'm sure that those sort of conversations must have had an impact on her writing as well.
Probably. You know, again, it's hard to know what influenced her. She talks about it in the letters some, but not a lot. Bernice has mentioned many of the writers she references. I want to point out that the Oz books were a particular favorite of hers, and she would read them almost every night to whatever children would assemble at her feet to listen. And for years she did that. And I graduated, but still there were three others, you know, crowding around trying to see the pictures. Shirley loved reading them, and she loved reading aloud, and Tolkien as well. I think my sisters and my brother got more of that than I did. But Shirley loved reading aloud, and she had a very distinct reading voice. Unfortunately, there are only a couple of recordings of her, but she had a kind of a low, lower tone of a voice when she was reading, and she would read slowly and deliberately, and she would leave pauses very nicely in her reading for effect. So it was really almost hypnotic to listen to her read aloud. And audiences loved it when she would read from her work, which she also loved to do.
Wow, that's fascinating. I was going to ask about the, does she seem to have a sort of distinct a voice that comes across in all the different genres she was writing in, or whatever the word would be, like those, like the new magazines like Good Housekeeping, but then also her more like gothic horror novels. Do you think there's some sort of like a singular thread that you could piece through all of her work?
You know, I'll hand this off quickly to Ellen and Bernice, but I think that her tone is very similar in the comedic works and the serious work. I mean, she constructed beautiful sentences in any genre. And she was just a very polished writer, especially the later work. And I'm particularly fond of the increasing use by Shirley of the semicolon. She writes early on that she detests semicolons, doesn't want to use them at all, and finds them a bother. Whereas in her later novels, the text is crammed with semicolons. She might write an entire paragraph consisting of one sentence punctuated with semicolons, and it works beautifully. And I mean, that's a particular interest of mine. And I think it's significant. I think that it showed how her writing style really did develop and change and evolve in a very nice way. And of course, that brings up the question of what might have happened had she not died so early. But we'll leave that alone for now.
Ellen, Bernice, I'll ask you the same question.
Well, I think her voice is very varied and her themes are varied. You know, you can see the theme of, you know, the seemingly normal middle class, or, you know, life and the bubbling of horrible things underneath. But that's, you know, that's not the only kind of story she wrote. So I see her as a branching out more than that. I can see when Stan, you know, when Lawrence says about the semicolons and her, that part of her writing is similar. But as far as thematic things and the way she deals with them, to me, it seems very varied. And I don't see one thread. I see several threads. But Bernice is more of an expert on that, on her writing, than I am. So take it away.
No, I think you're right. There's a lot going on in Jackson, which is part of the reason why she's so much fun and so interesting to study. I think one recurrent sort of through line that does happen again, or a couple of things, is that she's the queen of the opening paragraph. I mean, the opening paragraph of Hill House in particular is, you know, if you had an opening paragraph competition, if it didn't win first place, it would certainly place very, very highly. But actually, even some of her lesser known novels have superb opening paragraphs that are both, have you feel instantly that you're with someone who just knows so expertly how to set up the story that follows. I mean, like the opening paragraph of We've Always Lived in the Castle, you know, everyone, it ends with the line, everyone else is my family is dead. I wish I had been born a werewolf. I never remember these things, I'm afraid. I used to be able to quote them word for word. So she's superb at setting up her novels in particular. The other thing I'd say just quickly is that a through line that really connects both her sort of family sort of non-fiction or sort of less fictionalized stories and the fiction is that she's always superb at balancing the everyday and the macabre. So that's something that she's consistently really, really excellent at, where scenes that seem like they're going to be something, just a perfectly normal exchange, actually something really sinister happens in them. But conversely as well, I think it used to be the case that, you know, critically, her humorous writing was almost kind of siloed off from the rest of her oeuvre, whereas actually they're all part one and the same, really. They're all of course connected, and there are macabre moments in the family stories, usually leavened with a great deal of very morbid black humor. And also there are incredibly funny moments in a novel like Hill House or Castle, which may more traditionally be seen as kind of a more tragic or kind of darker turn. So I mean, she managed to work humor into almost everything that she did in a way. So I think Jackson the humorist is actually a thread that kind of ties things together as well.
Yeah, like I said, making my way through the letters of Shirley Jackson, the book, but luckily one of my coworkers has actually been reading it for a little bit as well, so she was able to send me some questions and ideas she had. And one thing that stuck out to her as she's been reading it is her humor that comes across in the letters. She just seems like just the kind of person that was just kind of naturally funny and just kind of had that about her. Lawrence, I don't know if you could speak more to that.
Sure. Yeah, I think that at heart she was a humorist. She was very funny in real life. I mean, she loved jokes. My parents would tell jokes at meals back and forth, and it was almost, you know, you were required to show up with a new joke. But she loved humor of all sorts. I went to many movies with her, including some very funny ones, and she loved going to the drive-in movie, frankly, and would take me and my sister if she was old enough. And she wrote humor. I think that she had a marvelous way of transforming family catastrophes into hilarious stories. And she just was able to do that. And you can see it in the letters, where there's some scenes, you know, where she's driving Stanley to the airport and they go, or to the train station, and they go, they're stopped by a flood. And it just turns into a series of emergencies from which she emerges at the end. But she found these things very, very funny, and she could write about them in a humorous way, especially when she's talking to her parents or Jean Beatty, with whom she had the freest exchange. And I think the Beatty letters are by far the most, well, they're all interesting in different ways, but the Beatty letters are very illuminating and revealing, I think. And Shirley just really in them lets her hair down completely. And that's really fun to read. It's stream of consciousness, but see, a lot of material is coming out. And Bernice and I had a whale of a time editing those because they're all good, and yet you can't have all of them. So we had to make some hard choices.
That's one thing we talked a little bit about Shirley's writing process. I'm interested in both Lawrence, you and Bernice's process on the letters of Shirley Jackson, and also Ellen, yours on, you mentioned, we were talking about a little bit earlier on getting the short story anthology together. So I wonder if Lawrence and Bernice, if you could talk about that editing process first with the letters of Shirley Jackson. I know you had to, had to find the letters in the first place, right? And go and explore them, read through them. So I'm wondering if you could just kind of take us through what your process was for getting the book together.
All right. Well, briefly, I had a lot of the letters to begin with. I had all of her letters to her parents, which my grandmother, Geraldine, gave to me when I first moved to San Francisco decades ago. And she said, I hope one day you will publish these. So she gave them to me, and it took me a while to work up the courage to read them. But then I did, and I was instantly transformed back into my childhood, reading about my childhood. She was so descriptive in her accountings of things. And so I knew that eventually there should be some kind of publication of them. And about 5 years ago, I decided that there were probably, well, after the Beatty letters came out in the biography by Ruth Franklin, I realized that there really was a wealth of material and it was worth collecting. So I got what we could from the Library of Congress. We had the Beatty letters. I had other letters that Ruth had sent me, some of the Olson letters and other informal letters that Shirley wrote. And I owned all the Brant and Brant correspondence. So I went through that and found many of the just crisp, wonderful notes that she would write to her agents. And so I collected as much as I could. And I started out with about 1,300 pages typewritten. It was literally a cubic foot of paper. And at that point, I called on Bernice. And Random House was encouraging me to find someone with whom I could, a Jackson scholar, with whom I could basically collaborate on this. And Bernice was wonderful. I must say, I value her contributions immensely. She read everything. I remember having to scan and send everything. There was a lot of scanning going on, but she read the entire collection, and then we started culling, and we knew that we had to cut it by half at least, and it was a hard process, but we did it. And again, Bernice would often, I would say, I think we should cut numbers 14, 16, and 71 or something. And Bernice would say, well, I'm with you on the first two, but I don't think you should cut the last one. And she'd be right. And, it was a great, I think we had a very good back and forth relationship on this. And I hope it shows in the final editing.
Bernice, what was it like for someone like yourself who had studied Jackson for so long to read these letters?
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. I mean, I'd read a lot of extracts from the letters. I mean, obviously they're quoted very extensively in both the biographies, and particularly in Ruth Franklin's biography, which is the first one to bring to light the wonderful Jean Beatty letters. But actually, as Lauren said, there was a lot of material, and it was really incredible to read the originals. Luckily, most of them were typewritten rather than handwritten, because Shirley's handwriting is challenging, I think we might say. So yeah, it was intense. I think there was a good year really of getting the first first version of the manuscript together. And so we were in communication really, I suppose, nearly every day at one point to get things done. And we had a time difference, which actually I think worked quite well, because are you a day ahead? I can never remember, but you're San Francisco, I'm Dublin. I know that. So it actually worked out quite well, where you could kind of send me stuff overnight and then I could look at it and send it back to you. And so we were able to kind of look at new material every day, I suppose, if I could put it like that. So in an interesting way, the time difference, I think, worked in kind of helping us to get through material quite quickly as well. But yeah, it was tough. I mean, as Lauren said, it was there was stuff that was fairly obvious in terms of deciding to cut it, because it maybe there were some letters that repeated stories that had been told elsewhere, for instance, etc. But there was a lot of material that it kind of, you know, some of it maybe broke our hearts slightly having to take out, but we just couldn't include it all. So I hope what we have there. I mean, I believe it is a really good representative sample of what she wrote and you know, who Shirley was.
Yeah, and let me add too, I agree with everything Bernice says, but you know, I think also we knew we couldn't include every letter. We knew we couldn't include letters to Shirley. That decision was made very clearly at the beginning. I knew that there just wasn't room. Too bad, because a lot of the correspondence is equally interesting, especially from her agents, who would just give it right back. I mean, the back and forth was really wonderful to hear or read. But there were a number of letters that were repetitive, which we could eliminate. There were parts of letters that went on and on about things that we felt just didn't merit the cut and didn't stay. So we cleaned them up a bit, but we didn't really touch the text a lot. I mean, we didn't rewrite anything. We might eliminate, but we really didn't change anything. And really, I think the important part of this is that it shows Shirley's arc from being a love-struck college student through the years of hard work and getting established, and then the later years when she's professionally accepted, she's a best-selling author, and struggling still with her writing and having writing blocks and dealing with them. We can see the arc without having to read every single letter or every single part of every letter. And I think it really gives a very fair and accurate picture of my mother.
Yeah, it's almost like an autobiography of sorts.
Well, yeah, it is. And I believe, and we've talked about it, this is really the autobiography that she didn't write.
Right.
And I think she wouldn't have written an autobiography. She had a lot of trouble writing about herself. And lots of times magazines or publishers would ask her to supply a biographical sketch about herself. And she would struggle with those things. I mean, we have copies of dozens of false starts where she would get into it, two paragraphs, and then start to meander and get silly. And I don't think she could have written an autobiography. But I think that when she was writing these letters, she knew that they would be published one day, or she thought they would be, suspected that they would be, hoped they would be. And so I think she wrote them the way she writes anything, with an idea that they should be written well, that they should be interesting to read, and that they were clear and understandable. And certainly the letters are all those things.
Ellen, I want to pivot a little bit to your short story anthology, When Things Get Dark, Stories Inspired by Shirley Jackson, which came out in September?
No, it just came out a couple of weeks ago.
A couple of weeks ago, okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sorry, time's all messed up for me. I want to hear a little bit about that book as well and your process. And
sure.
You mentioned it a little bit earlier, but yeah.
Right. In July 2019, I went to ReaderCon, which is a regular convention that takes place outside of Boston and awards the Shirley Jackson Awards every year. And I was looking for a new anthology idea. And I think someone probably mentioned, why don't you do something inspired by Shirley Jackson? I said, oh my gosh, what a great idea. But I'd have to contact the family because I'd want to do it with their blessing, or at least with them not mad at me. And I said, I don't have time. I'm not going to deal with it. So actually a month later, I attended a convention, I think the WorldCon in Dublin, and a publisher, Titan, had a book party, just a party for the convention, for the professionals. And I went and I met one of the editors there. And I said, do you mind if I pitch you an idea? Which I usually don't do. You're not supposed to do that at parties. But he seemed amenable. And I've been in the business enough long enough to know that you're not supposed to do it. But he said, sure. And I mentioned that I wanted to do an anthology with him, a non-theme horror anthology. And he said, yeah, that sounds good. Let's see. Well, time goes on and say, no, we're not going to do that. Do you have any other ideas? And then they came up with the Shirley Jackson idea. And I never told them that I had already thought about it a month before, but gave it up. But I told them, well, I have to contact the estate because I don't want to do it without their blessing, or at least their, you know, what I said. And so I contacted Lawrence and he said, yeah, yeah, it sounds great. You did say it. I have the email. So I started doing it. And then I, you know, made a list of the writers who I feel have been influenced by Jackson, Elizabeth Hand, Kelly Link a lot. And actually one who I didn't really realize it until I got her story in, Mary Rickert, M. Rickert. She writes really sometimes horror, sometimes science fiction, weird fantasy. And her story, which I think opens the book, seems to me almost the most Jacksonian story in the book. And I didn't realize that. I mean, I've read other things by her and I've edited her before. And the more I edit her, the more I realize, oh my God, you know, she definitely has been influenced by Jackson. Anyway, she's in the book. And there were other writers who I thought would do a good job. People who I've worked with before, Jeffrey Ford. And then there are ringers, you know, people who I didn't think would be interested, like Stephen Graham Jones, who writes for me a lot, but I never thought he would be interested in writing a Jackson story. And Benjamin Percy writes horror. And he wrote a story that is more horrific than I think, more overtly horrific than Shirley would have written. And Laird Barron is one of my favorite horror writers, and his story is one of the creepiest I've read of his, and it's probably the creepiest in the book. And but it's subtle, and it's not until you finish it and it's like, oh my God, you know. So that's basically how I did it, and I'm really happy with how the book came out because I think it's a real variety of takes on thematically, tone, voice. I think one writer did deliberately try to use Shirley's voice. Shauna McGuire and her story tried to use the sentence structure a lot that Shirley uses, but she was the only one who did that. And she did it deliberately, and I think it works. So that's basically how it came together.
Wow, that's cool. It sounds like quite the process.
It was fun. It was lovely. Yeah. It was lovely. Yeah.
Right. And it makes me think, you know, you mentioned a lot of people who have current writers who have been influenced by Shirley Jackson. I'm curious if any of you want to share why you think that is. Like, why is her work so enduring and so widely read, and not just by, you know, popular audiences, but also by writers themselves who cite her work as being majorly influential.
Because it's wonderful. Because, yeah. Because it has so many amazing elements to it. Because it delves under the calm and creates and finds the chaos under it. Why not? What's not to love? You know, it's subtle. It's usually pretty subtle horror. I mean, usually, not always. I mean, some of it's pretty obvious. But and a lot of the writers who I think have been influenced and love her work, they appreciate that.
I think from readers' points of view, not writers being influenced or influencing, but just the appeal of Shirley's work, I think is due to the fact that it's very timeless. It could be anywhere or any time, and it's extremely relevant more and more every day. I mean, the sundial is today or tomorrow even. And even Hangsman is very relevant. It's, you know, it's the hero's journey, and that's a universal story. So I think that readers discovering her work are not at all put off by the fact that it was written 60, 70 years ago. It's real now, and it's exciting, and it's scary, and it's, as Ellen says, it's just fun to read.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are writers who I'm surprised have been influenced. Paul Tremblay, his novel, A Head Full of Ghosts, one of the main characters named Mary, I think. And it's about an exorcism, maybe, about two sisters. And I said, I emailed Paul. I said, this is influenced by We've Always Lived in the Castle, right? He said, well, yeah. I said, like, I knew it. I mean, obviously, but it was great. It was really good. So that was kind of fun to discover that. And I realized also after the fact that I believe at least one of Clive Barker's stories has been influenced by Jackson, by An Ordinary Day with Peanuts. I can never remember the title of his story, of Clive's story, but it has people betting on frogs and a random thing. And it's, you know, it's world leaders are actually creating events. And I have to ask, I've never asked him, but it occurred to me, I have to email him and ask him. So, okay, have you read Jackson? And is that, was that an influence on that story, or did it just come up with it?
One thing I'm curious about, I always like to ask this question. It's maybe one of those is, you know, we might not know, right? But it's a question of how do you think if Shirley Jackson were alive today, how she would be engaging with our current world and all of all of its problems and you know, whatnot. But I don't know if anyone can guess at that.
I bet she'd be appalled, but yeah. I don't know.
Shirley Jackson on Twitter is something to ponder.
Right.
Someone like her, who I think had such a talent for a quip or an incisive remark, might have done very well on Twitter. But yeah, it can be a dangerous territory for writers too, I think, at times. I mean, she's someone who sort of managed to write so incisively about her own time. I'm thinking of a novel like The Sundial, which has this, like a lot of Jackson's work, has this wonderful kind of almost timelessness about it, and yet manages, is also very much of its particular historical moment as well, as many critics have pointed out. And she certainly have plenty of material to work with in the present day. I mean, I think one thing that would be interesting, I always wonder, you know, if the what ifs that accompany when a writer dies, you know, tragically young like Jackson did, is the changing roles for American women in, you know, when particularly second wave feminism really took hold in the late 60s and 70s, and to imagine Jackson sort of growing older in that particular context, and all of these changing social and political and cultural mores, and gender roles were obviously evolving quite a bit. It would have been obviously fascinating to see how, because that's such an important, like the restricted lives of American women are a huge theme in her work. And it would have been really interesting to see where, I think that there's nearly hints of that in Come Along With Me, where the heroine has essentially kind of run away from her old life, and Angela Motorman, isn't that her name? she's got a great opening line, I always believe in eating when I can, which I just think is another great example. But it's one of the one, you know, she certainly would have done something interesting. I mean, that's a very obvious thing to say, but it would have been worth reading whatever it was.
No, it's hard to know what she would have thought of the present situation. But I think more, I tend to think of how Shirley would feel knowing that her work is as popular as it is now, you know, 50 odd years after she died, and the fact that there are no fewer than 12 movies and episodic TV productions in development right now of her work, she would be, obviously she would be pleased. She might be a little surprised. And the words that always come to mind is wry amusement. Because I have to see her with her hand like this, half smiling, taking it in with an amused look on her face. And I think that's how she would look right now.
I like that. I can get that image too. does anyone have any favorite passages or quotes? Bernice, you've mentioned a couple of her, that she's the queen of the opening paragraph.
I don't have any particular quotes because I never remember them, and I left my volume Jackson in my office today, I'm afraid. But I mean, any of her opening paragraphs of the novels, I particularly like the opening to The Bird's Nest, where the juxtaposition between the heroine's mental state and the building that she's in, which it's a library, it's a museum, which develops a big crack in the wall. It's just so superbly done, and very, as Lauren said, wryly done as well. But one of my own personal favorites is It's a short story that she wrote in the early 50s, I think, The Beautiful Stranger, which is just a great title. And it's, I guess you could call it kind of an early sort of suburban gothic tale, but it's very ambiguous and eerie and elusive. And it's a woman whose husband comes home from work. She picks him up at the station and it is her husband, but it isn't her husband. And you could kind of almost call it, if you're, you know, almost as a kind of a, almost a sort of a body snatcher type story. And yet it is that and it isn't. But it has the most beautiful closing lines about the heroine looking at her own house and then not trying to go back home again and not being able to recognize her own home amongst the suburbs. And it's just, I can't remember the exact wording. I would just botch it if I tried to quote it. But it's just so beautifully done. It's so typically Jackson, you know.
Well, I love the opening of The Haunting of Hill House. Of course, I can't quote it, though. But it's a classic, you know. It's,
yeah, I thought your question was about the letters. And I think that there are, I don't have a favorite one, but there are some that are just exceedingly funny that I like very much. And in particular, one that Shirley writes to me in 1964, where she talks about my father's desk chair falling apart. And it's, I think it's one of the funniest paragraphs I've ever read. I would read it now, but I don't think I could keep a straight face doing it. But it's in the book. It's in November 1964, and it's very funny.
I just read the preface of the letters, and I think it's in your preface that you wrote, a brief portion of it at least. But yeah, it made me crack up on the train this morning. It's good.
I have a question for you too. Are you going to try to do a book of the letters that were written to her? It would be too difficult to get permission from all the people who wrote the letters.
Oh, I don't know. The bulk of them are from Stanley to Shirley, and they're equally wonderful. Mm-hmm. And the letters, the crisp little notes from her agents back to her, which mirror her humor, her style. Carol Brandt, especially, well, both Carol and Bernice, quickly became friends of Shirley's and trusted friends. And they would communicate by mail almost always, not telephone. Mm-hmm. But in those days, surprisingly, the mail would arrive overnight. So Shirley would write a letter and mail it to New York. Carol would have it the next day, answer it. The letter would come back in one day to Shirley. Incredible. We had that kind of postal service nowadays.
But it would be fantastic to have, you know, a book of those letters too.
Maybe, but then they'd be out of context unless, you know, we know what Shirley's saying. And I don't know. I mean, is it really interesting to know what Bernice Bumgarten had to say in 1953?
Depending on what she wrote.
Well, true, but it would be answering Shirley's letter. Mm. Stanley's letters are as colorful as Shirley's. Mm-hmm. Maybe someday we'll do those. That would be a separate kind of collection. I don't have and can't find most of the letters to Shirley from people like Kenneth and Libby Burke, Ralph Ellison, some of the people we have letters to from Shirley, but not their responses. I'm sure we could find them in one collection or another. But again, I felt that this was Shirley's story, not anyone else's story, even though we're all in it. And it's, I think it's a remarkable accounting. You know, there's one other thing I'd like to talk about, if I may, and that's the drawings. That's something that I feel very strongly about and wanted very much to have in the book for several reasons. Mainly, I think they're as funny and as relevant as what Shirley's talking about in her letters. And they're very pre-feminist views of what a woman's life was like in the 50s in the US, where Stanley is always pictured reading the New York Times in his overstuffed chair. Usually we don't even see Stanley. We just see the paper that he's holding. And Shirley's standing there holding a baby. There are dishes in the sink. There's a typewriter nearby. There's laundry on the floor. And Stanley is oblivious to all this. And Shirley is basically running the household. And that was exactly the way it was. But I think it's important to note that Shirley, well, first of all, we have more than 800 of these drawings done over years, but mainly in the 40s and early 50s. I think she stopped doing them in the mid 50s. But I remember drawings would suddenly appear on the refrigerator or on the study door or somewhere. And they'd be up for a few days and then they'd disappear and then there'd be new ones. And she loved to draw. And in fact, early in when she was in college, she was considering being a professional artist or cartoonist. Her father was a fairly accomplished painter and drawer and taught her. He also taught me to paint, which I value greatly. So she was very, very involved in visual arts. She also did a lot of painting, which none of which has been published. But anyway, I wanted to include as many of the drawings as possible. Bernice agreed, and we kind of had to talk Random House into it, but we did. And I think they really add a dimension to the book that is very, very good.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because you know the letters, you're showing the full picture, you're trying to show a full picture of her, right? And you got to include the drawings in it if that's the case. Yeah, I just looking through it, they definitely have, I think, like you added a great dimension. It's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Good. And some are very funny.
Yeah, exactly.
Feeling. I mean, the one the where she's holding an axe and, you know, that drawing she did many times, many versions of it. So it clearly was a theme. You know, it's like What a Thought, where the woman is considering bashing her husband over the head with a glass ashtray. Doesn't do it, but, you know, she considers it long and hard. And it's very tempting. And I think that's very revealing of, you know, I think women in the 50s who were assigned duties of housewife and nothing else may have been kind of bitter about that, and understandably. And I think it's revealed in these drawings very nicely.
I agree. And I'm curious what, we kind of mentioned it, but if you all want to take a stab at what Shirley Jackson's life and work has meant to you, both personally and professionally?
Well, without reading the biography, I wouldn't have even considered doing an anthology about her work. Reading that made me really interested in her and feeling very badly that she was what she was doing in the 50s and how corseted she may have felt by her circumstances. And it gives one an appreciation for how far women have come, you know, and that you can do so much, well, the cross-genre material, you know, the whole idea that she, her influence on other writers, as far as what you can do within a field, you know, within the field of fantasy and grotesque and horror and mainstream and literary and the mix of it. I think I appreciate that. Because I appreciate the fact that she's influenced the writers I work with.
Yeah. Bernice, how about yourself?
Yeah, well, in a sort of a personal and a professional level, Jackson's work has had an incredibly positive effect on my life and is the reason I am currently employed. But I first came across in Stephen King's great book, Dance Macabre. I was a huge King fan as a teenager, and I came across Dance Macabre, and he kept talking about Shirley Jackson, and I was determined I would read everything that Stephen King mentioned, which was actually a very good strategy for me as a future horror academic. And a family friend in the US sent over a copy of Hill House, which I got when I was 16, and it blew my mind. And then a few years later, I got a copy of We've Always Lived in the Castle, which again had to be ordered from America because you couldn't get her books here in Ireland. And when it came to think about what I wanted to do a PhD on, she was top of my list, and it was definitely the right decision at that time. And so she's led to my career really as a scholar of popular fiction and of horror and the gothic in particular. And I mean, she's just been a tremendously exciting and interesting writer to work on, and one of the great pleasures of working on Jackson is seeing the at first quite gradual, but now really a groundswell of really exciting critical work on her. There's so many up and coming, wonderful younger scholars in particular in the US and in the UK and Ireland. And it's just, it's brilliant to see. There's such interest in her, and it's, yeah, I'm really excited to see what the future holds for Jackson Studies, because there's a lot of stuff happening. So that's really, really positive.
Yeah. And I would agree that the, and Bernice assures me that this is a growing body of good critical writing about Shirley's work. I think that's really wonderful. Now, on the other side, I'm more involved with the adaptations. And as I mentioned before, there are lots of productions going forward. We've been held up by the pandemic and this and that, but things are moving forward very nicely. And I'm very excited about some of them. I'm involved with all. And I think that, in fact, every one of Shirley's novels is now under option, which, I mean, 10 years ago, we wouldn't have imagined that. So her popularity is growing exponentially, I think, in lots of different directions. Unfortunately, there is only so much work that she produced. So it's a fairly finite body of work. I mean, there is more, there's a lot of unfinished work. There's some children's books that never got completed that we're looking at again and wondering what we might be able to do with, because the good parts are absolutely magnificent and they're not finished, you know. So I've got to decide kind of where to go with that. But I think that on both in both cases, she is growing and finding new readers worldwide, really. I mean, every single day I'm licensing some translation or another and approving covers worldwide, literally. And it's wonderful. It's just great to see it all happening.
That is great, yeah. Lawrence, Bernice, Ellen, I thank you all for joining me today. I had a blast talking with you, learning so much. I just really appreciate you all taking the time to be here with me.
And I thank you all. It's lovely meeting you all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The next episode will air November 24th. If you'd like to learn more about the American writers and their impact on American history, our culture, and our daily lives, come check it out in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.